From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. I recently read a book that I was so excited about. It was filled with so much profound wisdom and also very inspiring, and it was written by Dr. Karen Wyatt. The title is Seven Lessons on Living from the Dying, and it's all about how to nurture what really matters. I think that's so important in the world. You know, she had the privilege to share the final months, weeks, days, and moments with many of her patients, and this unique experience gave her profound insights into death and dying. She learned that life looks entirely different to those near the end, and that dying provides you a rare backwards glimpse of the true meaning of our puzzling existence here on Earth. Her book also deals with the enduring and often unspoken taboo of our youth-obsessed society. The truths and revelations about death and dying are spelled out in this great work. Dr. Karen Wyatt is a family physician who has spent much of her 20-year career as a hospice medical director caring for dying patients in their homes. Dr. Wyatt has lectured and written extensively on end-of-life issues with an emphasis on the spiritual aspect of illness and dying. Dr. Wyatt recently retired from medical practice to focus her efforts on creative healing, a project to explore the integration of spirituality and Western medicine. And it is a joy and honor that she joins us today. Dr. Karen Wyatt, it's such an honor to have you on today's program.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to join you.
Well, having had 17 years as a hospice chaplain myself, I have followed your work. You certainly have had some great teachings out there. People can find you all over the internet, really. I love this book. It first came out under a different title, Seven Lessons for Living from the Dying. And I'm wondering, first of all, what was your inspiration for creating this book?
Well, it really came from my patients themselves. And over the years, as I sat at the bedside with dying patients, I heard their stories and I followed their journeys at the end of life and learned so many spiritual lessons from them, from what they were going through and what they were talking about. And one of my patients said to me, you know, I've learned so much. I finally understand what really matters in life. And yet I only have a few weeks left to live and I won't be able to tell anyone else all of this wisdom. I won't be able to share it. And he said to me, would you share it? Would you share my story with other people? And that moment, I knew that I was destined to write a book one day and share these patient stories and talk about the spiritual lessons from the end of life.
You came into the hospice movement actually through a great tragedy that you experienced. I read about it when I read the book Death Makes Life Possible, and you shared your story on a few pages in that book. I'm wondering if you would mind sharing that with my listeners.
Yes, yes. I had trained to be a family doctor, so I was newly out of residency with my own medical practice. I had my own little clinic and seeing patients of all ages and very happy doing that when my father died by suicide. And it was such a complete shock and so devastating to me. But I really went into despair and grief and guilt. And I had tremendous guilt over his death because as a family doctor, I was trained in behavioral medicine and I understood psychology. I worked a lot with patients with depression. So the fact that I wasn't able to save my own father and help him crushed me. I really struggled with this terrible grief and guilt for a few years and not knowing if I could even continue being a doctor. And then I got the inspiration one day to call hospice that maybe I needed to start volunteering at hospice in order to learn more about death and dying and grief to see if that would help me. And the moment I got involved in hospice and made my first home visit to a patient, I knew that that was the kind of medicine I was really meant to practice. That's where I belonged. So I ended up ultimately leaving family medicine and going into hospice full time.
Wow. Yeah. Your foreword in the book opens up with a powerful quote that I was not familiar with, although I was familiar somewhat with the work of Ernest Becker. And the quote says, "The irony of man's condition is that the deepest need is to be free of the anxiety of death and annihilation, but it is life itself which awakens it And so we must shrink from being fully alive. How do we walk that tightrope?
Yeah, I think that's actually just one of our greatest challenges of life. And I found that what was interesting for patients who receive a terminal diagnosis, when it's actually been made very clear to them that their life is limited and they have only a number of days left to live, that they confront that challenge and possibly for the first time recognize that this life was not meant to last forever. We're not meant to be here infinitely. It is limited. And it seems to me that that's the moment at which, for many of those people, they started to fully live, because they recognized this is short and precious, so I have to give it everything I have. Each day is going to be my best day. I'm going to give it everything I have. And that's what that clicked on for me as I observed that, realizing I could be living that way right now if I just acknowledge that I don't know how long I'll be here, so I have to treat each day as precious.
One of the things that I found intriguing in your book, under each chapter heading, The Seven Lessons, and by the way, I love all the quotes you use, because you remind me of author Wayne Muller, or if I were to finally write a book, I'd be doing the same thing. You quote from a lot of different religions and a lot of different spiritual sources, and I so appreciate that. But for each chapter, you're using a verse from the scriptures, the Bible. And so are you a Christian, or what was the purpose for that?
I was raised in the Lutheran Church, and so I'm not a member of any church now, and I feel like I've expanded from there, so I have kind of embraced all religions without being a follower of any one religion. Yeah. I've embraced all of that. But one thing that stuck in my mind, I remembered as I was working with my patients and learning from their experiences and their wisdom at the end of life, I remembered the seven words of Christ on the cross. And it suddenly struck me that, oh my goodness, Christ was a dying man on the cross. He was dying, and he was going through this very process my patients are going through as a human, as a man. And so I thought about the seven words of the cross, and what if that was actually a teaching from Christ about how to die and how we process life as we're dying. And so that was just profound to me, that realization. And so over time, more and more, I saw the words of Christ actually played out in the challenges my own patients were dealing with, like forgiveness, love, and surrender. That really informed how these lessons came together for me.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. I'm always intrigued, especially books that I really enjoy reading, such as yours, how the author was thinking in even organizing the book. And so the seven lessons, it came from the seven words, and I see how that process worked for you. That's amazing. Seven words are very powerful, the Christ said, of course. And of course, lesson one is something that a lot of people don't really want to talk about. They certainly don't want to experience it. And yet we all do. And the lesson was suffering, embracing your difficulties. And the passage you used was John 19:28, I thirst. What have the hospice patients, over the many years you served as a medical director, what were they teaching you about suffering or how to navigate that journey?
Well, I saw from some of my patients that they really viewed the pain they were in or the changes that have happened dramatically in their lives as a challenge for them to work through. And I saw many of them really embrace these changes of the dying process as something that would help them become even better people. And that was so inspiring to me. So I saw them meeting every step along the way with looking at it as how can I be a better person now? How can I meet this challenge now? And how can I deal with this the best way I can? And one woman said, this process is my process. This dying, the pain I'm in, it's mine. And it was given to me for me to learn from. So I'm going to learn whatever I can from it. And I had never in my own life really thought that way about difficulties and challenges. And so it completely changed everything for me when I began to see, what if I could embrace with that same attitude the obstacles that come along in my life and the difficulties?
Yeah, and by embracing that, knowing that suffering is necessary and that suffering is unique, just as every individual is unique, you also came up with some fruits of suffering. Can you share just a few of those with our listeners? Because there's probably some people who are listening now going through a hard time. It could be the illness of somebody they dearly love, perhaps even the loss of somebody, or maybe another challenge that they're going through.
Yeah, I have to look those up to make sure I get them correct.
Well, the one that struck me was humility, is having humility, because we rarely see that sometimes modeled in the world these days.
That is something that I think is really important right now at this time in our society, that we become humble. I feel that so often we've focused on pushing away suffering and even pushing away anything that makes us feel that we're not good enough somehow. I think we need to be more humble in life, and we need to be grateful for everything that has come to us in this life. And as we talked about before, when we embrace the suffering, we realize that we're not above the suffering. You know, we're not too good for that to happen for us. Everyone experiences suffering, and so we need to humbly accept what comes along in our life.
One of the things I enjoyed in reading your book is at the end of each of the seven lessons, you have a final teaching, if you will, sharing your insights under the heading, Tending the Earth. And I just loved that phrase. What does that mean for you, tending the earth?
I actually added that as I rewrote the book from
the
original version,
yeah.
Especially right now, because we really have to look at the earth as part of the gift we're being given and part of our lives. So I think it's important that we use our spiritual awareness and awakening to make us more aware of what's happening on our own planet and make sure that we're living life in a way. Something my father always taught me was like to live life lightly on the planet and gently and not take too much from what's available to us here. Mm. And so that's what part of humility in a way too, is to not ask too much of it. Take what we need and appreciate what's here, but live life gently. And so for me, I feel like that's something we really need to focus on right now.
Yeah. I loved what your dad was teaching you. I've often said to walk lightly on the earth, but for the same reasons. That is so important. Well, the second lesson I don't think would be a great surprise to so many people, but I loved your insights on that, and that's love. You write, once we have plummeted to the depth of our suffering and faced it openly and honestly, we must then begin to learn the next lesson from the dying. Let your heart be broken.
Ah, yes. And that's a painful lesson for us to learn, because I think in our society, our notion of love is that it's romantic and it's always full of joy and bliss. And yet, I think love is one of the most difficult challenges we face, because to truly love, we really do have to make ourselves vulnerable, and we have to risk being hurt and opening up the most tender parts of ourselves to other people.
Well, and that is so hard, because especially the older we get, we've gone through some hard times, especially in relationships. And so we tend to either consciously or unconsciously wall up our hearts. But you remind us in this particular chapter that, first of all, relationships are essential, so don't be afraid of them, but also connect rather than collect. What do you mean by that?
That we should be focusing our energies on how we can connect more with people and with other living beings in our life instead of collecting material goods. And that lesson directly came from the patient I was telling you who told me I just now figured out what matters in life, because he was someone who had spent his whole life amassing wealth. He was extremely wealthy and had many cars and a huge home and everything he ever wanted materially. And yet he had forsaken his relationships. He was estranged from his wife and son. He hadn't seen or spoken to them for years. And he was alone. And he realized he'd really squandered the thing that mattered the most, which was relationships and love, in order to have more material possessions, and realized those things just didn't matter in his last days of life. All he wanted were the relationships back again.
You know, how many times have you and I and so many others heard that? from people just like that. I'm remembering the quote from Steve Jobs, and he said, remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You're already naked. There's no reason not to follow your heart. And yet, for a good part of his life, he was pretty ruthless. But it took having cancer. It was like a wake-up call, I suppose.
Yes. And I love that. I love the fallacy to think that we have something to lose. These possessions of ours are precious. So if we have to take care of them. We have to maintain them. We have to protect them at all costs. Mm. And yet there will be a day when they will mean absolutely nothing to us. Mm. And it's painful that when we don't know that earlier in our lives, we only discover it when we get to the very end of life.
And so we learn. I know I have through the hospice patients I've served. You certainly have, because you document it in this wonderful book, that we find love. The smallest acts of loving kindness can convey the greatest love. And you remind us, giving before receiving. Now, I have to say, I have not seen this movie, Marvin's Room, that Diane Keaton stars in, so I need to watch that. But can you share a little bit about what you gleaned from that movie and the character she portrayed?
Yes, the character portrayed by Diane Keaton, she is a single woman who's caring for her aunt and her father, I believe. Mm-hmm. As both of them are ill and near the end of life. And so she's devoted her whole life to taking care of them in her home. And her sister comes to visit and is kind of amazed that she's been able to do this with her life and sacrifice her life. That's how the sister views it, that she's given up everything in order to be to give this care to their loved ones. And she said, I do this for love. And she said, no, you obviously love them in the care you're giving. And she said, no, they love me. It goes both ways. She was receiving and giving love in the deepest way possible, and that made her life so rich and so meaningful.
Yeah. What in your life, not only as a medical director of hospice, but just life in general, because one of the lessons you also talk about, and I think it's perhaps one of the most challenging for people, and that's forgiveness, to hold no resentments. What are you learning about that for you?
Well, one thing that I worked on all throughout my hospice experience, because as I mentioned, I went to hospice with this huge burden of grief and guilt over my dad's death. And what I discovered over the years is that, first of all, I needed to forgive my dad for taking his own life because I was angry at him. I couldn't admit that or allow myself to look at that for a long time, but I was angry at him for making that choice, and I needed to forgive him. But even more than that, I needed to forgive myself, because it was blaming myself for his death that was really tearing me apart. And it took a long time. That was a long journey of unraveling all of that and being able to forgive myself for that, and then discovering other things I saw as mistakes, choices I had made, things I had done, that I needed to just let go of all of that self-blame in order to really grow spiritually. I had to stop beating myself up over things I'd done in the past.
Yeah, because don't you find that by not forgiving, it's really hurting us, not the person that we're choosing not to forgive?
Yes, exactly. And we create our own little stories inside of us about why we're not forgiving. And oftentimes, those stories end up not really even being accurate about what happened in the past. They're just a story that came from our perception of what happened. And we spend so much energy keeping those stories alive and maintaining the bitterness and resentment that we have inside of us. And it's such a relief when we can finally let it go.
Karen, when I was reading that chapter, I couldn't help but remember, it was many years ago, after I had just started working in hospice, we had a patient who was an abuser. He was an alcoholic, and now he was dying. And we didn't know how long he had, and his family wanted nothing to do with him, and his only wish was to see his first grandchild. But we understood why his daughter, who was abused by him, did not want to do that. She just couldn't do that. So the social worker and myself, we did what we could. I remember I got called out to attend a death at that facility. And after I was done, I walked by that room. It still brings me to tears thinking about it. I look in the window, and there's that man propped up, and he's holding his little grandchild, and there's family in there, and it was his birthday, and they brought balloons, and as hard as it was for them, they chose to forgive him by giving him that last wish that he had. And I'll never forget, first of all, the joy on his face, but what it took for that family to do their own forgiveness in order to do that.
Wow. Oh, that's such a beautiful story. And I agree, I've seen it before. I think that when a person is dying, it's an opportunity for their family members and their loved ones to also experience that forgiveness, and that will change their lives forever.
Yeah. I've learned, I know you have too, and perhaps a lot of other people have through various teachers out there, that being present or presence is really key. Often hard to do, but you actually have a lesson called presence. Dwell in the present moment. What did all of these precious souls who you served over the years, what were they teaching you through their life and through their own stories about the lesson of presence and how important it is?
Well, I observed that with my dying patients, and I'm not sure they would even realize that what they were doing was being in the present moment. But I saw how much they appreciated every tiny thing in their lives. And for example, if a patient was watching the sunset, in their minds, they would realize this might be the last time I'll see a sunset. And so they would notice every color change, and they'd watch until the colors completely faded in the sky and take all of it in. And another patient, when I got there to visit, was eating a dish of ice cream and describing to me how amazing it was and the taste of it and the coldness and how wonderful it was and how much they were enjoying it. And I thought, you know, I don't ever really enjoy anything in my life to that extent, but they're enjoying it because they recognize I may not have this chance again. And so this is going to be the best dish of ice cream I've ever had because it might be my last one. And so then I suddenly realized what they're doing is just making the most of the present moment. And it showed me how rarely I ever did that, how often I was either tied up thinking about the past or worrying about the future in my mind and not even really paying attention to what I was doing right now in this moment.
Yeah, I've often said that the awareness of death is the secret of life, because just as you're documenting so many of these people, it took that crisis in their life to really stop, to slow down their mind, to slow down their life, to inhale that sunrise or sunset or flower and take time to be with it. I love the Thich Nhat Hanh quote you have in this chapter. He says, "The most precious gift we can offer others is our presence. When mindfulness embraces those we love, they will bloom like flowers." And boy, I'm sure you've had all kinds of experiences like that just by you offering the gift of presence to those you served.
Yes, and that was a lesson. I was grateful to finally learn that, because I remember in my early days in hospice, I always wondered, like, what should I do? What should I say? Will I do the right thing? And I was always trying to think of what I could do for the patient, and it took a while for me to recognize all they need. They actually benefit the most from me sitting with them in stillness, if that's what they want, listening if they want to talk to me. But I didn't really have to do or say anything but just being there and being calm and being with them. Yes. Was all that they needed. And so I eventually learned that I could teach that to family members too, who are caring for their loved one, or some who were afraid to go visit a dying loved one because they didn't know what to do or say, that it's really just being there. Yeah. That makes the difference.
Yeah. Yeah, what you just shared, that's exactly what I experienced years ago when I first started. I thought I had to really have the right answers, and I was thinking about everything I learned in my master's as a counselor and all this and that, and then I had an epiphany one day, which I won't get into, but I decided next time I'm going to see this one gentleman, and I'm just going to be, and I'm just going to put my hand on his arm, just going to look eye to eye, heart to heart, and it was one of the most powerful experiences I had with hospice patient. And so then I started to learn about that healing power of presence. We think we're not doing anything, but we're doing so much more. We're often wiser by not opening up our mouths.
Yeah, so true. I remember, you made me remember, we had a patient who was an elderly gentleman who lived alone, who was obsessed with baseball. And every time our staff members would go visit him, all he would talk about was baseball, his favorite team, and, you know, what their scores were and games he'd been to. And our staff was really frustrated because they said he's not doing any of the work he needs to do. You know, as he's dying, he's not talking about the rest, other parts of his life, and he's not working on forgiveness. Like, how do we get him to do that? And so I went to see him, and I remembered, like, just be present, just sit with him. And I listened, I sat with him, I listened to all of his stories about baseball, and at the very end, he said, I have a son, and I haven't seen him for a long time. And he said, because I left his mother, I walked out of them when my son was little, and he said, the thing I regret the most is that I never took my son to a baseball game. And suddenly it's like, once we listened to all these baseball stories, we could get to what was behind it and really hear what he needed to say from his heart. And so we didn't need to say anything. We just needed to do more listening.
Oh. Okay, Karen, you're making me cry. We need to. That was a very touching story. Very touching story. I think every guy who's watched the movie Field of Dreams gets touched by something like that. So, in the section of Tending the Earth in that chapter, you write something that really touched my heart as also an environmentalist. And you said, to hold the earth as sacred requires us to dwell in the present moment, because awe and reverence are experienced only in the here and now. Two of my favorite words, awe and reverence. Now, you guys live in beautiful Colorado. What have you learned, not only from the dying, but just slowing down enough to enjoy the beauty of nature, about awe and reverence? And how has that helped you in your life and in your spiritual journey?
Well, I've learned that I can quickly nurture and replenish myself simply by walking outside and being in nature, and being present, being still and silent, and just observing nature and feeling this pulse of life, you know, that runs through the flowers and the trees and the grasses and the breeze flowing by and the water and the stream, and just taking all of that in. It nurtures me, and I instantly remember that we're connected with this nature as living beings, and we all have this same energy flowing through us. And that's when it brings me back to that place of just observing, being in awe and observing how miraculous it is that this life exists, this life force that's in us and in nature as well is even here, and how amazing it is to be here and being grateful for this opportunity to be on the planet. And that's true even today, as we're dealing with a lot of challenges right now.
Yes.
On planet Earth, and even in the midst of those challenges, and there's a lot of anxiety and fear, but to be in the moment, present with any part of nature, even if it's just a flower growing in a pot, I think brings me back to that place of gratitude and remembering that it is a privilege to be here and to be alive right now, no matter what's happening in the world.
And as we're embracing what you just shared and embracing our own mortality, knowing we don't have forever, it brings up another lesson that I've been pondering a lot, many others have, and that's purpose, manifest your highest potential. And I love the scripture you used to start off that teaching. It's Matthew 27:46, which says, my God, for this I was kept. This is the destiny for which I was born. How important is it for people to identify or to get a little clarity in their reason for being here? What is mine to do?
I think it's very important, and partly because I see a lot of people spending their life force energy trying to figure out what job should I have, what career path should I follow, mm-hmm. and which may not be the point. The point may be more, who did I come here to be, and mm-hmm. that my purpose is really to become my best self, and it may not matter which job I have. I can probably use any kind of job to grow and learn spiritual lessons and become my best self. And if we put our energy into that, into focusing on how do I learn what I need to learn, and how do I practice forgiveness and love and become a better person, then I will truly know that I'm on my life path. And maybe I have to change jobs. Maybe I lost my job and I have to find something else to do, but that doesn't matter. I'm still on my path. I'm still growing and learning on my path. And I think in that way, we can embrace all the challenges and changes that come to us and not feel that, oh, I failed at this. I didn't do the right thing. I didn't do what I was supposed to do. We can remember that it isn't really about the external work we do. It's much more about our inner work of our spiritual growth.
Yeah, and truly being vessels of love. Not to put you on the spot, and I'm going to give you a little information here about this story, but and specifically a quote that really touched my heart deeply, and it's a story of Ashley, and you write in the beginning, from the moment I first heard the case of Ashley and her parents at our staff meeting, I dreaded my visit to her home. Ashley had been diagnosed with a rare progressive neuromuscular disease while she was a toddler and never been able to sit upright on her own or walk, and breathing and feeding were difficulty. And you share more about that, but I want to kind of jump over. You write, though she was in a deep sleep, I spoke to Ashley before I began to do my exam, explaining who I was to reassure her that I would not hurt her, and describing how I would listen to her heart and lungs. This was my usual practice with comatose patients who can still hear, by the way, thank you for reminding us of that, and process information and should always be treated with respect and gentleness. After I completed my exam, including checking the tube that had been inserted into her stomach for feeding, I pulled the comforter back up over her arms and chest. Then Ashley opened her eyes, turned her head toward me with a wondrous smile and said, "I love you." And her eyes penetrated me, and I felt an electric sensation run through me that I can only describe as pure heavenly love. What was that like for you in that moment?
Yeah, I have goosebumps right now just remembering it and how profound it was. And in contrast to what I feared before I went to visit Ashley and her parents, that I feared that her parents would be angry and bitter and resentful that their child had suffered so much and they had spent 20 years taking care of her. And I thought, okay, I'll have to deal with their anger and how upset they are and how betrayed they feel by life because this happened to their precious little daughter. And suddenly I realized that this channeling of love, and I called it being a vessel of love, that is the highest purpose any one of us could have on this earth, no matter who we are or what we're capable of, to be able to show love and offer love to another person in that way. What a profound gift that is. And we don't have to have a functioning body. We don't have to be able to have a career or have a job. We don't, that Ashley in her state was able to just transmit this beautiful divine love.
Yes.
Proved to me that it really is not about what we're able to do or accomplish. It's really just being and making the best of whoever we are at the moment. And her parents told me that she had learned to say, "I love you," before she got this disease. And so those were the only three words that she could say. And what a profound gift. And then they told me she's been doing this her whole life, saying, "I love you" to people. And so they were actually ecstatic and elated to be taking care of her, because because they were supporting her in being able to offer this love to everyone that came to visit her.
And what a beautiful dance of not only purpose but presence. Because the way you described it, it reminded me of many of my friends who have gurus, and they talk about the holy gaze, much like Jesus probably gave to others. And it changed you. It touched your heart so deeply. I find that so powerful. The other thing that I love also, and I've learned this word, mystery, from one of my favorite teachers, Father Richard Rohr, and about embracing the mystery. It's not always about certainty. It's not always about goal setting. It's not always trying to have that stinking plan that we get so frustrated with, because life doesn't work that way. As a matter of fact, you say ultimately the future remains a mystery for each of us, and we must find a way to live with that fact. What are you learning, Karen, about embracing the mystery of it all?
Well, I think that's an especially important lesson right now as we're going through this global pandemic together. All of us have had to sacrifice all of our plans, all the things that we thought were certain. Everything's up in the air now. You know, there isn't one event that was planned for later this year that probably will actually take place or that anyone can count on taking place. And it's such a huge reminder to us that that's not really what life is about. We're truly in the right in the middle of mystery right now, and the unknown and uncertainty. And all of us are being asked, can you walk through your life every day completely uncertain about what will happen tomorrow and still make this day be a full day, a precious day that's full of life and love? And it's an amazing opportunity we have right now to really, really work on that.
I'm sure you saw that played out in many of the patients that you served, that, you know, they know now they're going to die. And there comes a point when many of them, not all, but many, do that ultimate surrendering, because death is the ultimate surrender. And that segues into one of the other lessons that you've learned and that you're sharing with so many others around the world, and that is the lesson of surrender, letting go of expectations. And when we do, it brings us so much freedom, but it's so hard to do for many people.
Yes, it really is. I think the way our society functions in many ways is to create expectations. We create schedules and plans for ourselves, and we have expectations of how things should be and how they should work out. And yet, you know, Buddhism teaches that's the root of all suffering, actually, is being too attached to what we want to happen and what we think should happen. And we can live life so much more comfortably if we stop attaching things. Of course, we do need to make some plans, but we have to always be in that state of not knowing for certain if those plans will work out or not, and being able to let go of them if they don't.
Mm-hmm. There was an individual who crossed your path. It was a patient. And you said when you first learned that Andy was being admitted to our hospice, I placed a phone call to a medical school classmate of mine who was a specialist in the disease that he had. And the disease, it affected his face. And I think your friend who was counseling you said about 25% of these patients take their own lives during the course of treatment, so be prepared for that. What do you recall after all these years of your relationship and your experience with Andy?
Again, that was another profound patient who taught me so much. Again, because it made me face some of my own fears. Hearing about him, that he had cancer that had really eaten away half of his face, so that eaten away the flesh, so the bones were exposed over half of his face, and so his appearance was very disfigured, and it made me think about my own fears of something like that happening to me, and how could I even live with that in that state? And yet, Andy had just come to this place of complete acceptance of that this is just how life was for him at that point, and that he was still going to get the most he could out of life. And he had two children, and wanted very much to be here as long as he could to watch them grow and be with them. That's what he cared about. And so I was just profoundly touched to see how courageous he was and how willing he was to be here, even with this horribly disfiguring condition, and to not be resentful or bitter about it, to just accept it as, you know, this is now what I have to deal with, so I will.
And what a powerful lesson of surrendering. When you read this, and I encourage my listeners to get a copy of this book, when you read this story, it's heart-wrenching, and I too couldn't help but think, oh my God, what would I do if that was the disease I had? I want to die in my sleep. Can I choose that, God? You know, instead of going through something like that. But you do talk about the seeds of surrender that are important. Of course, surrendering to the mystery is, but also surrendering the outcome. And I have found in my life, I was slow learning this, but it helped so much more not being attached to the outcome, because, I don't know, was it the Buddha who taught that attachment is the key to all suffering?
Yes. Yes, like you said, that I've found that definitely to be true. I've placed way too much importance on how I think things should work out. And when I do let go and I go with what is happening, usually I find it turns out far better than I could even have imagined. something different comes along or happens, but it turns out to be far better than I ever would have conceived of in my own mind.
Yeah. And then we talk about another word that has become important in my life, especially because of the hospice work, and that's impermanence. And that's facing your fear. The scripture used John 19, it says, it is fulfilled. And so you write, the final lesson to be learned from the dying is to face your fear by embracing the concept of impermanence. What have your patients and what have you also learned in life in general about the importance of impermanence, and how have you incorporated that into your life?
Well, this again is something that's just so foreign in our society.
Yes.
I think to acknowledge and be aware in every moment that everything changes and everything that's living ultimately dies on our planet. I mean, that's just the reality of how life works and how things function here on our planet. And yet we're in so much denial about it. And I think we're constantly trying to make things last and trying to prevent change, trying to keep things the same as they have been, which ultimately does make us suffer, because it's a futile task. We can't make everything last forever. We can't prevent change from happening. So we spin our wheels and expend all of our energy trying to keep things the same. And one thing I recognize in my own grief process, trying to deal with my dad's suicide death, I initially, for about 3 years, I held on to this thought that if only I could go back to the way things were before, that every day I would wake up and think, one day I'm going to wake up and I will be exactly who I was before my dad died. I'm going to feel exactly the way I felt then. And that's what I wanted. And that's what I was trying to achieve.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I realized, oh, wait, everything about me has changed because of his death. And I have to allow that, and I have to let go of trying to stop life from changing and going on. And as soon as I was able to let that go, I got to a place of much more peace. So I think that's what happens. But I think this impermanence, it's a Buddhist teaching, but it's rather uncommon in our society. The idea of watching things come and go, and if something falls and breaks, accepting, oh, okay, that it was time for that to break. It was time for that to be done with that item. You know, it's gone now, and that's okay.
Wow. So this book has such a beautiful flow to it, not only the profound insights and wisdom, but also, I think, from the lessons we've been talking about: suffering, love, forgiveness, presence, purpose, surrender, and then impermanence. And so, Karen, which of the seven lessons in the book do you think has the greatest impact on a person's life?
I would say forgiveness, because I think forgiveness in some ways is the key, is one of the keys to the other lessons, tied with love, because I guess I see love and forgiveness kind of come together in a package. But forgiveness is the stumbling block for so many of us. And once we can forgive, it's much easier to be in the present moment.
Yeah.
And then I think from there we can lead on, lead into finding our purpose, being our best selves, letting go of things, and, you know, just accepting the impermanence of life. But if we don't practice forgiveness and we can't do it in our lives, it really keeps us from growing in all the other ways we need to grow.
Yeah. And what suggestions do you have for our listeners who are struggling with grief or perhaps even personally with a terminal illness?
Well, I think the first thing is looking at that idea of suffering, and that suffering is built into life and part of life. So whatever you're experiencing right now, rather than to think of it as this should not have happened to me, and fighting against it as if I shouldn't be in this place, this never should have happened, but turning it around and saying, this is what happened. So this is my life. This is what life gave me. I'm going to just accept it and be with it. And so when we stop fighting it and being angry that we are where we are, suddenly we open ourselves, and then we can begin to receive insights and greater understanding and clarity about where we are. So I think that's the first step. And I think it's really important to have some sort of a daily practice, just a time to set aside from the hustle and bustle of daily life for stillness and quietness, whether it's prayer or meditation or journaling or going for a mindful walk, but some time that's quiet and still when we can do some reflection within. I think just even 15 minutes a day can make a huge difference and gives us an opportunity for those insights to come to us.
What? I so agree. I think that is such practical and sage advice that we need to be doing, encouraging people to do that. You know, I'm wondering, with the vast experience you've had in this whole death and dying area, books you've written, lectures you've given around the world, I'm curious, how will you prepare for your own experience of death and dying?
Well, it's really important to have that practice, a time for a practice every day. As I work on these seven lessons, every day I acknowledge, you know, this could be my last day. I don't know how long I'll be here. So I feel like I'm every day preparing myself for anything that could come my way. And then also tending to my relationships with my family and making sure, you know, well, my brother is a person that we've had a challenging relationship in the past, but making sure that as much as I can, I'm working on how do I constantly show him that I love him? How do I let go of anything from the past that's in the way? Because I want to reach my last breath being free of bitterness and resentment. So I constantly work on how can I make my relationships better and heal any wounds from the past so that I'm always at that place of peace.
Yeah, and I've also been reading so many powerful testimonies from people around the world who have been touched by your teaching, by reading this book. It's really changed their life. I'm wondering, Karen, as the author, how are you different from writing this book?
Well, it was interesting because as I sat down to write the book, first of all, I had a writing teacher, and she said, well, if you're writing about these seven lessons, you know, you're going to have to live all seven of the lessons before you can write about them, which I didn't really want to hear. And so she was right, and it took me 12 years to write the book because I had to live all of the lessons. And so as I started to write about the books, there were so many more insights came to me during the process of writing, and things happened in my life during that time that I was writing the book that actually made me see, oh my goodness, I thought I knew how to surrender before. I didn't know anything. Here I am completely surrendering as I try to write the book and try to figure out how to put it out in the world. So the very process of writing the book walked me through all of these lessons and made me live them even more deeply in my own life. And so I tell everyone, write things down, write your stories, write down what you're experiencing in life, because I think putting things on paper is a really powerful way to observe your own process of growth.
Absolutely, absolutely. The book is Seven Lessons for Living from the Dying, How to Nurture What Really Matters. Such an important read, especially now more than ever, I think. Karen, can you share a web address for people to learn more information about you, and also how can they get a copy of this great book?
Well, the best place to start would be my website. It's eoluniversity.com. That's for End of Life University, and that's where I share all of my materials related to end of life. And so I have a podcast and some blogs there and some courses and other information on that website. So that's probably the best place to start. And the book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble online. And if bookstores are open where people live, they should be able to get it from their bookstore as well.
Dr. Karen White, thank you so much for the light that you're shining in our world and the gift you've been to so many over the years. It's a very, very important book and topic, and it's been a joy and honor to have you on today's program.
Thank you, Richard. I've enjoyed it as well.
Why? Well, because awareness of death helps you heal old wounds, refine your purpose, and lead a fearless and authentic life. It helps us remove the triviality to truly live each day. So reflecting on death is an antidote to even laziness. Death tells us that we must live now, in the moment, and that tomorrow is an illusion. The hospice patients that I've served over 17 years as a chaplain, they often spoke of the simple pleasures as being the best. Reminded me of some of the stories I read in Karen's book. To listen with the heart, to be heard deeply, to touch with care, and to be held with love, to notice the stars in the sky, and the smell of the earth, and to reflect these miracles back to the universe with a grateful heart, to give something back to humanity. These are the things that give life meaning. And so, every day, I pray that we keep our heart open and embrace the beauty of this day. Now, in closings, I want to share some thoughts out of this wonderful book, The Seven Lessons for Living from Dying. Karen writes this towards the end of her book. The following year, I sat with my friend Mary Lou, who was in the final weeks of her own struggle with breast cancer. She had read this book when it was first released and had decided to incorporate the seven lessons from the book into her own life as she focused on living fully day to day, no matter the outcome of her cancer treatment. She told me the book had eased all of her fear of dying and allowed her to live also without fear in each moment. In fact, she'd given the book to all of her family and friends to read so that they could join her on this fearless path. I told Mary Lou the story of my mother's hollyhock miracle that day, knowing that she would appreciate the simple beauty of the tale, and Mary Lou smiled as she shared her family's own little miracle. Her daughter Leah had planned to get married that summer in Hawaii, where she lives, and Mary Lou had desperately wanted to travel to attend the ceremony, which had been scheduled many months in advance. She had set her intention on the date of the wedding and focused on remaining strong enough to travel to Hawaii to see her only daughter get married. But a few weeks before the wedding day, it was clear that Mary Lou would not be able to travel that far for the ceremony. Her health was declining rapidly, and much to her disappointment, she knew she could not withstand the physical challenge of such a journey. When she told Leah and Rich that she couldn't be there for their special day, the couple instead flew to Colorado to be at her bedside. They had canceled their wedding plans entirely in order to be with Mary Lou during the last weeks of her life. I asked Leah how she had gathered the courage to cancel her wedding at the last moment when they had been planning it for months, and she answered simply, "Because we know what really matters. Being with my mom is more important than anything right now." And as a result of Leah's love and willingness to let go of her plans, Mary Lou was able to see her daughter get married after all. They held a spontaneous makeshift ceremony on the deck of their home, complete with hand-picked wildflowers and homemade wedding cake, while Mary Lou watched from the comfort of an outdoor lounge chair. Leah told me that simple celebration was far more meaningful to her and Rich than the elaborate wedding they had planned in Hawaii. And to complete the story, when the newlyweds went on a brief honeymoon to a cabin in the mountains, they were amazed to find rows of beautiful hollyhocks blooming all along the fence that surrounded the property. As I sat with Mary Lou's family that day and listened to their beautiful story, with hollyhocks once again making an appearance, I recognized the power of love to support and inspire us through our most difficult journeys on our most precarious paths. We cannot control the challenges that life brings to us. We cannot orchestrate the events that ultimately shape our experience here. We do not know how our mysteries will unfold in the days to come. We can only do our best on this journey to open ourselves to love in all its manifestations and disguises. We must first love ourselves enough to release the grief and guilt and fear that cripple us and close our hearts. And then, when we've finally broken down the walls that protect us, we can become the perfectly flawed and cracked vessels that are capable of radiating love to all of life. And so another chapter in the quest for what really matters has come to a close. But the path remains before us, and the journey is not yet complete. Therefore, with this map of seven lessons as our guide, we take up our packs and walking sticks and set off on the trail life has designed for us, one step at a time, watching for the appearance of hollyhocks along the way. Again, that was from the book Seven Lessons for Living from the Dying, How to Nurture What Really Matters by Dr. Karen Wyatt. It was a joy to have her on the show. Thank you again for listening. That is today's program. Thanks for joining me here on WICR 887 FM. All shows are podcast on my site, richardbrendan.com. And so for engineer Kylan Talley and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.